Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As Afghanistan prepares for its runoff elections in June and its first peaceful transition in leadership in decades, we'll look at the status of women there. By virtually every measure, women's rights in Afghanistan have greatly improved since Taliban rule. Yet while laws protecting women are on the books, far too often, at certain times in certain areas, custom will supersede the rule of law. And events like honor killing, forcibly arranged marriages, segregation education, virginity checks, and prescription against women's free movement still remains. With the coming withdrawal of NATO troops later this year, many worry about the fragile state of women's rights. My guest today is Charlotte Ponticelli, who has worked for many years, both inside and outside of government, on behalf of women in Afghanistan. She has 23 years of U.S. government experience, serving most recently as Deputy Undersecretary for International Labor Affairs at the U.S. Department of Labor and the Senior Coordinator of International Women's Issues at the State Department. Currently, she's the Program Director for the American Committees on Foreign Relations and a consultant and an adjunct professor at the Catholic University of America. She's a member of a number of boards and organizations devoted to women's affairs in Afghanistan, including the Bayat Foundation, the Initiative to Educate Afghan Women, and the U.S. Afghan Women's Council. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Charlotte Ponticelli, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
As NATO forces make preparations for the withdrawal from Afghanistan, what are the greatest fears surrounding the curtailment of women's rights? We've seen some advances. There have been some setbacks in that over the past 12, 13 years since the end of the Taliban rule. But what would you say is the biggest fear concerning the curtailment of women's rights in Afghanistan?
The biggest fear right now facing the women of Afghanistan and the young people of Afghanistan, too, if I may, it's the fear that we're going to leave them, that once again we'll turn our back and walk away. That is their biggest fear right now. We're talking about this issue, the situation of women in Afghanistan, at a very historic and actually exciting moment. You know, they just had some very successful elections on April 5th.
With many women candidates, too.
With women candidates. I think there were 300 women who ran for provincial councils. Women were, I believe, about almost 40% of the voters. 7 million people voted in Afghanistan out of an electorate of 12 million. Now, when was the last time we had a 60% turnout?
Especially when there's the actual threat of bombs.
And thank you for pointing that out, because there had been some very serious and shaking, I guess you could say, very disturbing incidents of violence leading up to the elections. The Taliban had threatened that they were going to create mayhem in those weeks leading up to the election, and they delivered. So when election day came, I think the Afghan people surprised them. They're so proud of themselves, because they'll say, look, we had nasty weather. We had all these bombings in the week before. Everybody said, oh, our security forces weren't going to be enough. The Electoral Commission wasn't going to help us. All these fears, uncertainties, challenges. We showed up. We voted. We not only voted for the women, we ran for provincial councils. And for the first time in Afghanistan's history, there was a woman vice presidential candidate on a major ticket. And she's a wonderful woman. I used to work fairly closely with her when she was a co-chair of our U.S. Afghan Women's Council. I was on the State Department, and she was Minister of Women's Affairs in Afghanistan. Since then, she has worked for the past 6 or 8 years or so as governor of Bamiyan Province, the first woman governor in Afghanistan's 5,000-year history. Women are becoming the firsts in a lot of fields. And the young women, to your question, yes, they're proud of their participation in the elections, but they're also very cautious. They know they have to be tempered with a note of caution, because the challenges ahead are very clear. And a lot depends on what we here in the United States of America decide to do in terms of continuing to support them in what they term a situation of life or death.
What exactly can the U.S. do, given the fact that we're going to be withdrawing our troops, withdrawing NATO troops? What is it exactly we can do to protect these nascent women's rights that have occurred around the country? I mean, everything from schooling to running for elections.
You know, and here's how, after having worked by and for and alongside so many incredible women in Afghanistan over these past 12, almost 12 and a half years, I can tell you, because this is always, I mean, my conversations with them are ongoing. So I can tell you that it's pretty clear what the game plan needs to be if we're to maintain the progress, make sure that we're not creating a vacuum, security vacuum, that the Taliban and the insurgents will be all too eager to fill, and to make sure that we're not undermining regional security. So this is about the situation of Afghan women, but the situation of Afghan women is inextricably tied to the situation of the country as a whole. They're the canary in the mine. Mm-hmm. To continue to support them, we need to do this. One, we have to be clear and consistent about our commitment. We cannot tell them, we support you and we care about you, but hey, everybody head to the door. It's contradictory. So that leads to the second point. We have to maintain a robust residual force, at least 10,000 troops, that will continue to do that hard work. I don't mean bullets. We've just seen the triumph of bullets over ballots, ballots over bullets, I should say. But that security force, or a residual force on the ground that can continue to train, advise, and assist the Afghan forces so that they can do the work that they need to do and they want to do for themselves. But if a zero option would not be an option, certainly for the women of Afghanistan. And third, in terms of our development assistance, project assistance, there's a lot we can do through public-private partnerships and the people-to-people support for the NGO and the humanitarian boots already on the ground. Those civilian organizations, civil society organizations that are working in all the areas of major concern to Afghanistan. And those areas would be education. Education is the tool that the insurgents fear the most. Youth. 70% of Afghanistan's population is under the age of 25. This could be the biggest investment for the country by supporting young people in their quest for education and jobs, or it could be the recipe.
Yeah, child labor is still a big issue in Afghanistan. I mean, even though the laws are in the books, a lot of kids are still working full-time jobs at 8, 9,
right.
10, 11, 12.
Child labor is still a problem in many countries. I think there are 20 million children around the world. Child labor is an issue I covered pretty intensely when I worked at the U.S. Department of Labor. I will say one big problem for women and girls in particular, and it's one that's often under the radar, we're not looking enough at, but it's a real problem, is forced and child marriage. I think according to a UNICEF study of a couple of years ago, approximately 60% of the young women of Afghanistan are promised into marriage, forced, whatever, they have no choice really.
Right.
Child marriage under the age of 16.
Right. And in fact, a lot of times that will be to settle a family debt.
Or to try to get a family out of poverty. Basically, it's a way to get money or a dowry, or fathers will say, I have 10 children. I have to sell this daughter because she can help me feed my other children. So again, that perpetuates that cycle of poverty, oppression, and violence.
And if I can stop you for just a second, because that's one of the things as I was doing reading, that's one of the biggest issues on women's rights in Afghanistan, is that, like child labor laws, there are child labor laws on the book in Afghanistan, but it's custom supersedes that a lot. When you're talking about arranged marriages and forced marriages, there are laws in the book against that, but customs take precedence. In fact, even in the court system, customs, a lot of times, customary law will have precedence over laws on the book, even in a court of law.
Well, I think this is why it's very significant, looking at those challenges, which are very real. And Afghanistan is Afghanistan. But it's not the Afghanistan we found 10 years ago.
Right.
Again, I point to this tremendous historic event of Afghanistan's first democratic transition in its 5,000-year history, the April 5 elections.
The first president who will leave office alive.
That's right. That's right. And the participation, who were the civil society and the sectors within the population? For the first time, the candidates, I talked to an Afghan woman last week, and she heads up an organization called the Afghan Women's Movement. It has a couple of thousand women that are members, and they are moving ahead with societal change. They are changing attitudes, and they are forging a new path for women. She said, leading up to the election, we met with each and every candidate to see where they stood on where we, the women, fit in. And we tape recorded their messages. So whoever wins, they're going to hold that candidate's feet to the fire. You're right. There is a culture of impunity when it comes to some of these transgressions and abuses. The women and the youth are determined to change that equation. And for the first time, we're seeing a word creep a little bit into the headlines. That word is transformation. Education is going to be key for young women and young men. It's going to take a generational change, but they're committed and willing to risk their lives.
You certainly saw all three presidential candidates cater to women's issues. I mean, there was not a candidate that says, I want to go back to the old days. All three of them basically made promises on behalf of women's rights in Afghanistan. Right. That's probably a first. Or at least
it is.
Yeah.
It is a first. Like I said, the fact that these Afghan women's groups, civil society groups, discarded the threats, met with the candidates, put their feet to the fire. And they're very, but not only that, there's a savviness about some of the Afghan women that I meet with now. 10 years ago, they could hardly voice what their agenda, how they would go about it. They were so grateful for any advice. I mean, it wasn't just, oh, we'll write you a check and fund a project. It was, give me the means, the skills. Once somebody gives you skills, nobody can take it away. When I remember those first women I met with 12 years ago, and I look at the women I'm meeting with now, they're confident, they're articulate, they have a vision, they have a plan to go forward. The young people do too. But that's why we've invested. It's because of America's sacrifice. And they tell us that. They'll say, look, nobody handed us this progress. We fought for it, but you did too, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Mm. You mentioned the three things that the U.S. should do, which is one is clear, consistent support for women's rights and for the development of Afghan society and government. Troops on the ground, residual force. A lot of people want that zero option. They want all of our troops out. How bad would that be if that actually came to pass? And where is the government at this point? Where is the Obama administration on whether they're committed to that residual force?
Excellent question. Of course, there are different signals. One gets out of Washington, D.C., but having been a veteran of Washington, D.C., I can tell you that's no surprise. I did read what I thought was a very good interview on Pakistan TV as I was flying out here. I believe the interview took place on April 25th, so just about a week ago. And it was with the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, James Dobbins. And he was being pressed by this Pakistan. Dobbins was going through Pakistan after having visited Afghanistan. And so the journalist in Pakistan was trying to pin him down on certain questions. And he said, you know, well, what about the zero option? Dobbins said pretty clearly, the zero option is not an option for us. It's up to the Afghan people, meaning the signing of the bilateral security agreement, which the two leading candidates have each pledged that they will sign immediately once the runoff election occurs and we have a clear result in June. So a zero option in terms of women would be very, very difficult. They feel their gains are significant, but they are realistic. They're smart, and they feel that these gains are fragile at the same time. They're very fearful of negotiations with the Taliban as well.
Yeah. What about that third option, which you talked about, basically aid, continuing aid to aid this? I could see that getting cut easily, at least the governmental side. Can it sustain itself without government funding, or is that whatever government funding is there is pretty critical?
I think government funding is going to be particularly critical to maintain our U.S. capacity building efforts with the Afghan security forces, the army and police. With a drawdown on our part, the security situation could very well get worse real quickly. That flare-up of attacks I mentioned that leading up to Election Day was extremely disturbing. Hit very close to home for some of the organizations.
And you see what happened in Iraq, too.
Yes.
So, I mean, the Iraq history.
That's right. And, and that should be a warning to us as well. I think Americans, back to your other questions, you know, what do you do with the declining support here in the U.S.? I think Americans are also not only good people and caring people. We are smart people, and we do like to protect our investments. And I would say our investment, particularly for the women of Afghanistan and their families and communities, has paid off. It is one successful investment with the doom and gloom that make the headlines.
Well, it's been a deep investment in blood.
In terms of blood and treasure.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why the bond that I have personally have forged with so many wonderful Afghan women, from parliamentarians to teachers to midwives to young journalists, we have a very deep bond because each one knows what the other one, whether it's on the sacrifice end or the endurance end. So I think we have to protect our investment. I don't think we want a more costly demand that could very well come up. Yes, will aid be slashed? It's already being slashed. But there are things we can do through partnership initiatives and creativity. Technology is one area. I'm involved in a telemedicine project right now with the Bayat, B-A-Y-A-T, Foundation that focuses on maternal and child health. There are things we can do long distance through technology that could help a lot. I think our private sector partners here, businesses, foundations, there's some incredible partners represented on our U.S.-Afghan Women's Council that can still continue without huge chunks of U.S. aid.
But
they have to have security. Great point. Because we're already seeing some NGOs draw down. So it will be a chicken and egg thing. If we don't have that robust residual force, how can we continue our civilian surge to help the people of Afghanistan?
My guest today is Charlie Ponticelli. She is the American Committee on Foreign Relations Program Director. She served in the State Department, the Labor Department, and worked as an adjunct professor at Catholic University of America and 23 years of U.S. government experience. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Getting back to that idea that, you know, there's so many areas in which it's almost like there's this dual system in Afghanistan. There's the area of Kabul where safety is relatively good, and there are outlying areas where, you know, there's probably two very different tiers of women's rights in Afghanistan, I would assume, at least two.
You know, it's hard to say. And again, you know, if I were to look back over these 12 years.
Compared to the Taliban when women were under arrest, yes.
Each year brings its triumphs and its setbacks. Look, I live in one city and commute to another. I live in Baltimore and commute to Washington. Uh-huh. I can tell you at any given week, now there's no equivalent, obviously, between beautiful downtown Baltimore and beautiful downtown Kabul or Herat. But let me just say that like anything, there are triumphs, there are setbacks. There are times when you think, oh, this situation here in this province or in this city is going pretty well. And then there'll be an attack. The Taliban are kind of quiet since the election, and folks are kind of wondering what their motives might be. Are they waiting to see what happens with the next round of elections to decide? Are they distracted by events in Iraq and Syria? Do they have kind of a split in the ranks of their leadership? So it's kind of, this could be another law. I mean, but you know, Kabul, which people think, oh, everything's just wonderful all the time in Kabul, but you go out to this province X, Y, or Z, and it's really horrible. Well, you know, the major attacks, the most visible attacks that occurred, they were the worst attacks against Westerners, Western aid workers, and since 2001, occurred in Kabul just before the election. First part of January, we saw the bombing of the Taverna restaurant. It was a hangout for journalists. There were two young professors from the American University of Afghanistan who were killed, and Afghan people who were killed in that. The Taliban aren't always discriminating in their attacks about who they want to die from them. There was the Serena Hotel in Kabul, considered one of the safest, heavily guarded, whatever. There's a small NGO called Roots of Peace whose headquarters was attacked about a month or so ago. And most recently, a Cure International Hospital in Kabul. And some of the folks that I work with through this telemedicine project I mentioned knew at least one of the doctors, a pediatrician who was killed in the Cure hospital attack. So it demands vigilance. It demands smart and strategic thinking and smart military planning. And again, I keep going back to this. I think we've made an important investment. I think we've come a long way, and others believe that too. And if the Afghan people are determined to forge ahead, despite the threats and the challenges they face, then we should be prepared to walk at least a little bit more of the journey with them.
Yeah. Getting back to the Afghanistan government itself, it did introduce a number of reforms, but I noticed in the last few years, President Karzai has been siding more with, it's called an Ulema Council, I think.
Yes.
I may have the name exactly right.
Yeah, the Ulema Council.
Which
yeah.
is basically a group of clerics
Islamic
and
advisors,
jurists. Yeah, basically. And they provide guidance on the basis of Sharia law in Afghanistan.
Right.
And a lot of proposals and recommendations coming out of that council have been antithetical to women's issues.
Absolutely.
And women's rights. And unfortunately, President Karzai has sided more often with them in the last couple of years. He's had to back off on a couple of things that were especially egregious as far as
That's
women's
right.
rights goes. But how much influence does that Ulema Council have on government? And how much is it likely
well,
to have on the
you
next
know,
government?
Karzai had to backtrack on some of those pernicious changes
I mean, basically,
that he was going to make.
Strictly segregated education, a lot of things
and
about...
And having to be accompanied by a male relative when you left the house and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I would have to say, and I mean, that's a question that one could speak at length trying to answer. But I will say this. I think one impact or result that had, it motivated the women.
Mm-hmm.
And it reinforced their resolve. And the women did cause him to back down on some of that. The women still have an uphill battle. And more than the Ulema Council, one of their biggest challenges right now, and you've hit on a very important issue, not that having the law on the books or in your constitution, the rights protecting you, that's great. But if they're not protected, in fact, then what good are they? They're just on paper. So, but the Afghan women are determined, and the young people working side by side, young women and men, they're determined that the genie's out of the bottle and they're not going to go back. And frankly, Karzai, he's
the lamest of
history.
Lame duck.
He's very lame duck on this. And again, I'll go back to these wonderful women who were so active before the elections and met with the candidates and exacted some commitments. And they say, now we have their commitments, but we'll see what they do once they get into office. And each of those, the major candidates, Foreign Minister Abdullah, mm-hmm. he was actually a co-chair of our U.S.-Afghan Women's Council. So I worked very closely with him and with his main person on human rights and women's rights. I saw her last Friday in Washington. Zora Rasek, who was Afghanistan's representative to the Commission on Status of Women up in New York. This is the kind of people now who are women who are in charge and very savvy and know what needs to be done. So Abdullah, now candidate Abdullah, he has stood up a lot for women in Afghanistan, and I would have great confidence in him. And as well, Ashraf Ghani. A lot of the women leaders like him very much. They think his commitment's even stronger. And so the women aren't picking or choosing one over another. They see the pluses with both, and they feel they have a better chance. And I think Karzai is history, so.
My guest today is Charlie Ponticelli, the American Committee on Foreign Relations Program Director. She's a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on the status of women's rights in Afghanistan. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I would like to talk about, you mentioned how education is so key, and Pakistan has a great deal of influence on, and it seems like, from what everything I read, Pakistan has blocked textbooks from coming into Afghanistan. How much of influence will Pakistan have, especially with a reduced NATO presence, on that education piece, which you say is so critical for transformation of the country?
Pakistan does have its own challenges in terms of...
Internally.
And particularly in terms of... They have a lot of common concerns, I would say, the women and men of Afghanistan who are leading the way for change, as well their brothers and sisters in Pakistan. And particularly in the areas, not just this, on the security issue, but on in terms of, I mentioned jobs. Pakistan, too, has a very young population. So that's why education, investing in youth, investing in the same kinds of investments that I've talked about that are needed to help women and youth in Afghanistan are the same kinds. Each country is different, different degrees of difficulty, but they have a lot of common problems. They're right next door to each other. So education and health, education for boys and girls, jobs for women and men, health, and improved access to health care, because Pakistan has had a big challenge on the health front. I think that one good message I've heard come out of some of the recent discussions is the need for more economic integration of efforts. They're in the same neighborhood. The border is very porous. And again, why are we talking about how critical it is to support the women of Afghanistan? Because if we don't, they will be the canary in the mines. And to the degree that security disintegrates, it's going to impact Pakistan too. And so there's just a big, you know, I think people sometimes think, oh, helping women in Afghanistan, isn't that nice and a nice humanitarian thing to do? My point is, it's not just the right thing to do. It's the smart thing to do and the strategic thing to do.
Charlie Ponticelli, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Charlotte Ponticelli is the Program Director for the American Committees on Foreign Relations, a specialist on the status of women's rights in Afghanistan. She spoke on that subject last night to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.